The Guardian.
Good evening. Welcome to Politics Weekly Live and our end-of-year review. I'm Anoushka Astana.
And I'm Heather Stewart. And as we approach the end of another extraordinary political year, we'll be looking back at some of the key turning points.
And take you behind the scenes as we reflect on a year in which we had a snap election, we triggered Article 50, we lost a majority government and gained an American president, and are approaching the end with a government not looking that strong or that stable.
But it's not over yet. Joining us to wade through all of that, Anand Menon, director of UK in a Changing Europe, John Crace, The Guardian sketch writer and the creator of the Maybot meme, Theresa May's former strategy director Chris Wilkins, and Labour's leader in the House of Lords, Angela Smith.
But first, let's start with what I would say was the defining political moment of the year.
And what we're saying is the Conservatives are the largest party. Note, they don't have an overall majority at this stage. 314 for the Conservatives. That's down 17.
It was a moment of disbelief, I think, fair to say, for MPs of all parties and beyond MPs, frankly. Many thought that the exit poll wasn't true. As we know, it was. So what had happened? Well, first, we need to go back a couple of months. There was me thinking I was about to unwind towards the summer holidays when word came in of Theresa May about to give a statement outside Downing Street that was urgent and unexpected. Now, Heather and I job share the political editor role, and I was on, so I was desperately calling my contacts as I rushed down to Parliament. And Heather?
Yeah, I got a call from the news desk to say, where are you? The answer was, I'm in John Lewis in Brent Cross, buying some pants for my three-year-old son. Which, so I quickly paid for them and jumped in the car and got my way into the office.
Well, Chris, we've got to start with you on this one. I mean, it's obvious in hindsight that from your point of view, it wasn't a good idea. But what was the thinking? What was the thinking at the time, particularly given that Theresa May had told MPs who had voted for her in the leadership contest that she wouldn't do an early election?
Well, yes, maybe in hindsight, not the greatest idea of the year. There were a few driving factors behind it, I suppose. I think you have to remember that the context of the time was that we'd just been through the budget, which had famously slightly unravelled and shown really how much we were hamstrung by the manifesto that we'd inherited from David Cameron's time after 2015. And this was a prime minister, a new prime minister, who felt that the Brexit vote, as well as being a vote to leave the European Union, also said something about, more generally, about what the country wanted, which was about change, about social reform, about economic reform. And, you know, the budget had shown that actually, if you really believed in that change agenda, she didn't have a mandate to deliver it because she was still tied to a manifesto that wasn't hers. So I think it was really around then, around the budget, that we sort of started to really revisit the decision not to have an election, because she felt she needed her own mandate. But there were a couple of other things. There was also the realisation that on the existing electoral timetable, there would have been an election in 2020, just as we were sort of winding up the negotiations around Brexit, and that wasn't ideal timing. So there was definitely something about maybe moving the electoral timetable back as well. And I think you also have to think about, you know, well, actually, what was the alternative? And people sort of think, well, if she hadn't called an election, then she could just have sailed on for another 3 years with David Cameron's mandate. But actually, we weren't sure that was true. That as you went through the Brexit negotiations, and as you maybe began to make the compromises necessary to get those over the line, there would have been trouble within the parliamentary party. So again, giving her her own mandate to go into those negotiations was a big part of it.
Angela, tell us honestly, how were Labour feeling at the time?
Well, I think he's missed a point here, because I think the big driving factor for Theresa May calling an election is she was miles ahead in the polls. If she'd been behind in the polls, she would have never have called an election. She thought, hey, I can win this election. I have a strong and stable government. I'll have a bigger majority. And that worked well. So I think for a lot of MPs, they were very nervous. A lot of my colleagues in the Labour Party went away saying goodbye to people, not sure if they were going to come back or not. And the fact that we exceeded expectations. I was in a BBC studio through the night, and when that exit poll came out, it was yes. You know, and all that hard work, so many of my colleagues who'd gone out to their constituencies not knowing what was going to happen but gave it their all, Jeremy played totally to his strengths. He really enjoyed the campaign. He was out there doing rallies, meeting people. And it seemed to me for the Conservative Party to say this was almost a presidential style campaign, but the candidate for the presidential style campaign, we're not going to let out on our own or answer questions. So I think it was, you know, we play to our strengths and the Conservative Party play to all their weaknesses.
I'm very much not here to defend the campaign, trust me. Firstly, you know, congratulations to the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn, who ran a fantastic campaign, and you can't take that away from them, and it was you know, very impressive, and not what we expected, that's true. Obviously, the polls helped us call the election, but it's not true to say that we went into election expecting a massive majority and thinking it was a done deal. We talked about it long and hard. It was a gamble. We knew it was a gamble. But the polls obviously,
you're right,
they obviously made it easier to call the election.
She came out of Downing Street. One of the reasons she says she's calling the election because these nasty people in the House of Lords have tried to stop her, and actually she won the votes.
Seemed very nice to me.
Well, I can be on occasion. We take great pride if we helped call that election. It did the Labour Party a lot of good. But I think that was a misnomer. But there would not have been an election if Theresa May had been behind in the polls. It was an opportunist, unnecessary election.
We'll come back to some of these points. I mean, one thing that was clear, John, was that they thought they were going to take a lot of Yorkshire seats, which would have been taken had there been a large majority. And in fact, Theresa May chose to launch her manifesto in Halifax. I remember going up on the train with you. They thought they'd win that super margin. Well, actually, it's now a fairly safe Labour seat, 5,000 plus. Just reflect on that day, but also other days that you've seen her, and tell us all why you called her the Maybot.
Well, I actually christened her the Maybot about November last year. That's when the Maybot just sort of came to me. Because, I mean, we have to sort of go back a bit. As a sketch writer, you're very kind of privileged because you get a lot of time close up to the politicians and you're not stuck in the kind of cut and thrust of the sort of lobby reporters. You can take time to kind of reflect. And it sort of seemed to me that Theresa May had sort of risen without trace. She was the last person standing in a leadership election that Boris had excluded himself from after Michael Gove had knifed him in the back, front, everywhere you could look. And then you had Stephen Crabb and Liam Fox. I mean, Stephen Crabb went because nobody knew who he was. And Liam Fox went because everyone knew who he was. Michael Gove because he couldn't be trusted not to assassinate himself. And then we had sort of Andrea Leadsom in the runoff. And so Theresa became Prime Minister without saying a word, really. But, I mean, it sort of became clear to me that there was this image of this sort of strong and stable woman who was being kind of projected, particularly in the media, that was completely at odds with the person that I saw, who kind of had this disconnected, lacking confidence and inability to answer a direct question. There was something peculiar disengaged about her.
Just in a sentence, Chris, how mean is the Maybot label?
I think it's mean, but as with all these things, you know, it strikes a chord because people think it's accurate. And I think, you know, the election campaign in particular probably reinforced that, even though I know you christened her it before the campaign, but I think the campaign probably did reinforce it.
Well, at Halifax, as we may remember, she launched her manifesto and within it a rather unpopular policy, which a few days later in Wrexham, she did a major U-turn on. By then it had been labelled the dementia tax. I say she had done a U-turn. Theresa May was not about to admit it.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
We're being a bit mean by putting that up, but, you know, it was in response to our colleague, Jessica Elgar. I mean, just on that, was it a mistake to make the campaign all about her? And was it your fault or someone else's?
I feel you're getting it in the neck.
Yeah, can I just say thank you very much for that? Honestly, that's great. Look, I've said previously that I think, you know, when we went into election, we went into the election campaign with a particular strategy and a communication strategy, which were then not followed through to the campaign. So the communication strategy, actually, when we went in the campaign, was that it was going to be anything but presidential. It was going to be something that showed off the cabinet. It was going to be policy-based. We were talking about having quite a traditional campaign that would have things like sort of daily press conferences and that, things like that, where members of the cabinet would be able to talk about the policy issue of the day. It became a presidential campaign. That was the decision that was made. By the campaign team. But,
by the campaign team, he means Sir Lynton Crosby.
But in terms of the kind of producing the cabinet, the only time that Theresa went out with Philip Hammond, she pointedly refused to say whether he would still be Chancellor afterwards. I mean, there was a man who was handed his P45 in front of a press conference. It was extraordinary.
Do you want to?
No, I was just saying.
I'm feeling sorry for him.
I do think, thank you. We are going to cover other things, right?
We are.
I do think that, as John sort of alluded to, actually, you know, the Prime Minister has built her career around a particular strategy, which is about saying something when she has something to say and it being a serious thing. And I think, you know, through 6 years or whatever it was at the Home Office, she was very effective in that. And we took that strategy into government. How you then decide to run a campaign that is all about a presidential thing around this individual is not the route I would have gone down. I would have stuck with the strategy we had, which was basically making sure that, you know, she intervened when she had something to say. It was well thought through, which was a big why, after she took over at Number 10, the speeches that she made were a big part of building the brand around her. Because that was a conscious decision we took. I think we would have been better following that through rather than sending her around the country on a bus with her name on it.
And you went on that bus a few times, Heather.
Yeah, well, to the start of the campaign, they didn't let journalists on it at all. And then as it went on and as things got more difficult and they realised they were being slightly too controlled, they did invite people on. And I just remember one particular day, which was just terribly awkward. There were a couple of kind of very controlled speeches where we were all sort of cordoned off and there were no members of the public. It was very sort of awkward. She was talking in two businesses, but even, you know, the employees of the business couldn't really talk to her or get to her. And there was a moment on the bus, the journalists were all travelling on the bus, we're all trying to file our copy, you know, and the strong and stable mugs we'd all been handed are sort of jiggling across the table in the bus. And so at one point, one of our press team came out and said, oh, Theresa's going to come. She's travelling in a sort of separate compartment at the front of the bus. Theresa May's going to come out and chat to you. And what journalists are kind of, oh, God. This kind of incredibly awkward exchange, you know, where she comes over and you sort of all attempt a bit of small talk and it was all slightly hard work. And it really thought, you know, this we all know it and she all knows it. This is not going well.
And she was uncomfortable with it. You know, she didn't want it to be a presidential campaign. She didn't want it to be all about her. And she expressed that. But, you know, that's the campaign strategy that was decided. You're told that the numbers are good as you're going through it. You stick with it.
And I think it's just worth mentioning here, so as well as being strategy director, Chris has been chief speechwriter, but 15 years ago he was actually the speechwriter who wrote a speech for Theresa May in which she talked about the Tories being called the nasty party and how that needed to change. Given that we've given you a bit of a hard time, I mean, just tell me what she stands for and how that speech came about in the first place.
Well, that speech was about the thing that really sort of drives her, which is about, you know, she thinks conservatism should be about tackling injustice and giving a voice to people who don't feel that they have a voice. And at the time she made... No, well, that's her view. At the time, and what you've just reflected is the fact that, you know, certainly then the caricature, I would say, of conservatism was that it was about people with lots of money and, you know, it was about sort of toffs and things like that. And when she made the nasty party speech, what she was really saying is we need to challenge this agenda. And, you know, what she's done, you know, in the early months since being in Number 10 was talk a lot more about a conservatism that is about reaching into communities and responding to the concerns of ordinary working people and things like that. And that's really, that's what she was talking about back in 2002. She's been very consistent in that. And, you know, I think her record at the Home Office shows that actually, you know, she's done a lot of those kind of things. She has a very strong record at the Home Office in terms of tackling injustice and giving a voice to people who didn't feel that they had a say in politics before then. So I think she's been very consistent in that. Now, I think, you know, the election campaign probably took us a few steps back on that. But actually, that is the thing that drives her and that's the thing that animates her the most.
Yeah, OK. And just a very quick last question on this section to you and Anne before Heather takes us on to the other side of that election campaign. There was that stunning result at the end, which shocked us all. It didn't actually change who was in power, but it did tear down some of the long-held assumptions about campaigns, like the idea that you can't move polls more than 2 points during a campaign, or that manifestos don't matter, or that young people don't vote.
Yeah, I mean, the campaign was unlike any other campaign there's been. The shift in the polls was absolutely staggering, but the whole politics was unlike anything we've ever seen before. I mean, the voting patterns, the fact that working class people were voting Conservative in larger numbers before, the fact that Labour became the party of people with degrees, and what you were saying about giving a voice to people who don't have it, the poorer parts of this country vote Conservative and the richer parts vote Labour now as a result of this. I mean, it's an absolutely weird pattern. And it's actually, I mean, for me, one of the strangest things of the whole election was we were at an election party for another publication that's nowhere near as good as The Guardian, but shares just about its political leanings. And we were there when the exit poll came through, and the noise of the assembled throng of people, oh, they were quite drunk. It started as a cheer. And then it became a sort of strangled groan, because you basically had a load of centre-left people in this room who were Labour supporters but not Corbyn supporters, and they did not know how to react to this result. It was really strange.
Well, on that, Heather will take us over to the other side of the election campaign.
Yeah, and if it was an unmitigated disaster for Theresa May, on the other side of the aisle, it was, if not a triumph, then the next best thing for Labour. Far from being wiped out, as many of those MPs expected, as Angela said, they'd gained 36 seats, enough for a hung parliament. Suddenly, it felt like everyone in politics was singing along to this. Extraordinary scenes. And Angela, it wasn't that much earlier. In fact, it was after the election had been called that Labour got an absolute pasting in the local elections. What was it? We've talked about the sort of Tory side of things. What was it that changed on the Labour side?
I think it was a number of things were happening. It's really difficult to identify them all individually. But I think I saw a change about 10 days out from polling day. And you saw a real shift in how people were talking about the election. And unusually, things that went wrong played to our advantage. Things like, you know, the leak of the manifesto. Who would have imagined that would have been something so positive for the Labour Party? For 2 or 3 days, all people were talking about was a Labour Party manifesto. And then when we had what's called our Clause 5 meeting, where we sign off the manifesto finally, and we had that meeting, it was a really good meeting, people were very enthusiastic. And there were some changes made from the, I think it was probably 2 separate drafts that were leaked. And then we came out, and we had another 2 or 3 days talking about manifesto. So people were talking about policies. And it was a real distinct change on the doorstep. And I thought at the beginning of the campaign, I'd say, how did you vote last time? People say, voted Remain or Leave. They were thinking they were talking about the referendum. As we got throughout the campaign, they weren't talking in those terms. They were talking about policies and general elections. And I thought it was a very interesting shift as we went along. So you also had, you know, some terrible things happening in election, you know, Manchester during the election campaign. And I think that just made everyone stop in their tracks. And it's one of those things everybody knows where they were when they heard the news. And that, you know, in the middle of election campaign, everyone's just distraught about it. They're upset. Nobody feels like knocking on doors and talking to people. It's just not where you want to be or what you want to do. But you also have to realise those things do have a political impact. You don't know how it's going to respond. And I think there were other newspapers that overplayed their attacks on Jeremy and the Labour Party in relation to terrorism and security. And that was, perhaps I won't name the paper, but it's like 17 pages that Jeremy was a friend of terrorism. Of course that's not true. Of course that's absolute nonsense. And people knew it. But we then got onto policy issues like, how many police should we have? Where should police be stationed? And the Conservative record on that was very poor. So I think that drift into talking about policies, Jeremy never ever responds to personal attacks or makes them. That was very positive during the campaign. Well, he doesn't. You know, you laugh, but he doesn't respond. If people attack him personally, you don't. And so when this happened, it was quite funny. I was talking to him about the Glastonbury thing. And now Glastonbury is a really cool place to be. Jeremy, you know, is a man with a beard who wears a vest. You know, he does not think he's cool. And he got this amazing response. There was a real change. And it was a very exciting thing to be happening. If you were part of that and you were out knocking on doors and talking to people, you could feel the excitement building up as it went on. And people who had never voted before were telling us they were coming out to vote Labour. Non-voters were really key in being motivated then. And younger people.
Inside number 10, was there just a sort of
wouldn't be surprising, but did you just kind of underestimate Corbyn as a force, or was there an assumption that he could be kind of knocked out by the sort of negative attacks and the, you know, connections with terrorist groups and all those kinds of things? What was the perception of him as an opponent?
So before we called the election, we thought about how actually the Labour Party would respond, and we were extremely pleased to have kept it all terribly secret and make the statement as we did, and we were very proud of that.
Well done, you.
It wasn't just as a result of going walking with Philip in Snowdonia then?
There was a little more to it than that. But, I mean, to answer your question, Heather, look, I think we underestimated Jeremy, and I think we also underestimated the Labour Party. We certainly talked about... We anticipated, for example, that once we'd called it, that the Labour Party would spend several days thinking about how to respond and how to vote on the Fixed Term Parliaments Act and things like that. Actually, to their enormous credit, the Labour Party were incredibly professional and responded very well from day one. So I think we certainly underestimated him and them before the election. I think then, during the election, as I said earlier, I mean, credit to them for the campaign they ran. But they were able to run that campaign because we left the void for them to do it. You know, our strategy was supposed to be about change and about social and economic reform and about our policy agenda for the kind of Britain we wanted to create as we left the European Union. When we then failed to talk about any of that, we left the vacuum there for somebody else to step into it, and you know, they did it very effectively, and you know, you can't deny that. They did a very good job.
It was also quite interesting how the average age at which people were voting Labour went up during the campaign. People say up to a certain age people tend to vote Labour. As they get older, they're more likely to vote Conservative. And the average age at which people changed voting Labour went from, I think, from something like 47 down to 35. It was a real shift. So it wasn't just younger people. I think in every age group, apart from, I think it was just pensioners, really, the Conservatives had a majority. Every age group, they're either equal with us or we were far ahead. And that age profile is really interesting for the future.
Mm. And John, when you were out and about sketching Jeremy out on the stump, what how different was it to May's performances? And could you see it change as the campaign went on?
Yes, I mean, I could see him become energised, really. It was something sort of intangible about it. I couldn't put my finger on it. I didn't pick it up 10 days out. I picked it up more about a week out, actually, when going out, Jim. And I can remember going out to a place in Essex. I can't remember quite where.
Basildon.
No, it wasn't Basildon, but this was sort of the exact kind of area where Jeremy was meant to be doing really badly. And he was completely mobbed. And I kind of thought, and you could see, because he was with Emily Thornberry and with Keir Starmer as well.
It was Basildon.
It was Basildon.
It's all about Basildon.
Okay, it was Basildon.
Don't you remember me being there?
Yeah, of course I do. But, you know, and I can remember also that sort of Emily and Keir had been sort of slightly keeping Jeremy at arm's length in case he was sort of turned out to be electoral poison, and then kind of realizing that he wasn't going to be, and sort of sidling up to him and kind of and there was it became a much cozier kind of thing. And Jeremy as well became, in a way, as a sketch writer we kind of look for theatrics and the kind of personalities. In a way, Jeremy became the person he wasn't supposed to be. He became a professional politician, and he was out there loving people, kissing, you know,
I think he grew in confidence during the campaign. Yeah. This was the campaign in his strength, and he loves meeting people and being out there. And I thought that Basildon event was tremendous, and he impressed me at that. And there's been times I've been critical of Jeremy, but I saw him at that meeting, and I saw the genuine warmth, both beforehand, meeting people, afterwards and in the meeting. And I thought, this is where he is comfortable. This is where you see the personality come out. And people liked that, didn't they? That meeting, I thought, was amazing.
Yeah.
I didn't get a reception like that when I was the MP for Basildon.
Corbyn and some of his followers would say, part of this is about ideas, and the electorates, they would read the result as evidence the electorate is open to more left-wing ideas than we had previously thought. So perhaps, for example, could Labour have done better on a more radical manifesto in 2015? They think they've sort of shifted the centre of gravity. How true is that, do you think?
I think there's a deal of truth to saying that the referendum actually sort of broke the political mould. It sort of opened up possibilities because of the way that campaign had gone and what people expected out of it. And it was certainly the case that, and this was something that no one had quite expected before the campaign, that the Corbyn camp profited mightily from being able to talk about austerity, being able to talk about the need for more investments in public services. I think that was an absolutely key issue. And the Cameron legacy there proved quite toxic for the Tories, I think.
So it's as much about David Cameron and George Osborne's political choices as anything
absolutely.
That Theresa May. Chris, you're nodding vigorously over there.
And that's why after the Prime Minister got to number 10, the agenda for all that time was about change, because she had to be the change candidate, because you couldn't go into election owning the last however many years of a Conservative government, because that was always going to be the issue. So as we went into the election, you know, I certainly felt we should have been doing more to lance that boil before it became an issue, but we didn't, and therefore the Labour Party very successfully made it an issue.
Anushka, we were out and about quite a bit, weren't we, in different, sometimes together and sometimes in different places during the campaign. You did some sort of videos, didn't you? Did you sense things were changing, the mood was changing as it went on?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, actually with our producer here tonight, Phil Maynard, we made a couple of videos that were supposed to sort of represent the election, and the first one was, are the Tories now the party of the working class? And we spent a lot of time in some of those northern seats that you were trying to win. And I have to say, at the beginning of the campaign, on the road, a lot of working class voters loved Theresa May. And it was really amazing to see. And actually, what we saw during the campaign was a backlash from Corbyn supporters in those same constituencies against it. But we did go on to a lot of estates where people were saying they really liked her, they really liked her. That was before the nothing has changed moment. And then later on in the campaign, we made a film called The Corbyn Factor. And I just thought those rallies were absolutely amazing. And everyone kept saying this, you know, Michael Foot had rallies, but it didn't translate. And what I always felt at all the rallies were, this is not some sort of weird sect. These were loads of ordinary people who just absolutely loved Jeremy Corbyn. And on that, I've just got to read out Orla's tweet, who I assume is here. Even at Reading Festival, people were singing, oh, Jeremy Corbyn, he's a legend. He even has a Bitmoji, which I don't even know what that is. hashtag I love Jezza.
Hey. Excellent. And Anushka, do you want to take us on to what was the background to a lot of this, wasn't it?
Which was,
and Anne's alluded to it already, which was, of course, Brexit.
Yeah, that's right. You know, in March, Theresa May, backed by Jeremy Corbyn, triggered Article 50, and that began the official countdown.
The ayes to the right, 498. The noes to the left, 114. So the ayes have it. The ayes have it.
And off popped David Davis to Brussels to quickly sort out citizen rights, the Irish border and the divorce bill, wrap up a quick trade deal and tell the Eurocrats to go whistle for their money. Now, that was actually Boris, wasn't it? Sorry, I'm being a bit mean to David Davis there. And it's not quite how it's turned out.
No, it's nowhere near. I mean, I think anyone who knows the European Union would say that the negotiations have turned out exactly as you would predict them to. I mean, in this sense, the Brexiters were absolutely right. The European Union is legalistic, it's based on procedure, it's rigid, inflexible, and a nightmare to negotiate with. Well, yes, you were right. And now you're negotiating with it. It's rigid, inflexible. And the EU actually doesn't negotiate. The EU comes in and says, here is a list of the things we want. Call us back when you've ticked them all. And that's how the EU has negotiated trade deals throughout its history. And that's exactly what they're doing with us, because that's the way it does things. And we're discovering the hard way.
And interestingly in all this, Angela, the Lords have got a real role, but perhaps not the role that you felt Theresa May was trying to suggest outside Downing Street.
No, she was trying to push the blame somewhere else. The Lords are quite interested on this. And when we were debating Article 50... we had those saying this is a constitutional outrage that the House of Lords is even considering it. And then you had people saying you must block Brexit. And I spent most of my time for the 2 or 3 weeks leading up to the second reading on Article 50 saying, no, we're just going to do what we always do on legislation, which is we'll debate it, we may pass amendments, and we'll send them back to the Commons. And curiously, the two that we passed were the one on EU nationals, the rights of EU nationals in the UK, and having a meaningful vote at the end. And it was interesting that we really thought we had a hope of getting those through the Commons. But all the Tory, supporters of those amendments who've been egging us on and said they support it, just melted away as the government leaned on them to get a clean bill. And I think the government will find it hard to do that again when they just haven't fulfilled the promises they had. A great moment for me was when we had the Article 50 debate. It's quite nerve-wracking going into a packed house. And so there'd been all this hype and hysteria beforehand of what the Lords were going to do. It was trying to say, we just do what we always do. And there's limits to what an unelected house could or should be doing. So we go in and there's the hype there. The TV cameras are all outside. The house is packed. I'm about to make a speech. No pressure there then. And I suddenly, as I go to stand up, I get a note passed along to me along the line saying, have you seen who's sitting by the throne? And there was Theresa May sitting there watching me. Fine. And so I was quite, I had had some quite strong words in my first draft of my speech that some of the office said, well, you can't say that. As I pointed out what a ridiculous thing it was to say Brexit means Brexit. So I think I made some comment about what the most ludicrous political comment ever made, isn't it? Brexit means Brexit. And as I said it, I looked over this Theresa May watching me. So
did you feel guilty?
No. Not at all. Not a bit. It is ludicrous to say Brexit means Brexit. They still don't know what Brexit means, do they?
Well, I do have to ask you, Chris, as you're looking sheepish there, who came up with it?
It emerged from the leadership campaign, and I wasn't involved with the leadership campaign, so I couldn't tell you.
Well, would you advise them not to have done it?
Well, I think it was an effective line for what it was supposed to do at the time.
So, John, Brexit, many people in this room, I'm guessing, might think isn't a great idea, or maybe they do, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but it is a great thing for sketch writers, not least when you see scenes like David Davis today. I mean, often in our office, what you hear John say is, oh, I'll just transcribe it today. That'll do. Yeah.
Well, which is what I've done today, to be honest. I mean, David Davis wanders into the thing and says, when you say something's an impact assessment, you shouldn't assume there's any impact in there. And, yeah, those things that I didn't know existed, said existed, didn't exist after all. We were talking before, and I honestly, if this was a sort of FTSE 100 index, share index company, you would sack the board for this kind of stuff. It's kind of shocking. I mean, as for a sketch writer, we kind of love it when things go wrong, but there's a sort of element of sort of disbelief and tragedy about the whole thing now. You kind of feel that there are a whole bunch of people here locked into something that they don't really understand. I mean, even Theresa May, she was asked, would you vote for, to vote Remain again in the same way in the referendum? And she sort of couldn't answer. She couldn't defend her own government's policy. We have a leader who is following through a Brexit policy that she doesn't believe in herself.
Arguably the reason she's following it through is because there was a referendum and it was, perhaps simplistically put, but it was won. I mean, the complexities that we are seeing now, what are the most difficult points here? So, for example, the Northern Irish border, whatever they agree, perhaps this week, perhaps next, do you see that being solved before we get to a trade arrangement?
The next 2 weeks solve nothing. The next 2 weeks are simply whether or not you get a sort of amber light to go through to the final stage. So my sense is they will fudge it now. When it comes to the final deal, I don't know how you solve the Irish border, because you do one of three things, don't you? You either say, we're going to have a hard border, then the Irish don't sign the deal. Or you say, we're going to have a border in the Irish Sea, that means that the market in Ireland remains a unified market, then the DUP don't sign the deal. Or you say, the whole of the United Kingdom stays in the customs union and the single market, which gets rid of the problem of a border altogether, in which case the Tories don't accept the deal. So one of those three groups, none of whom are going to give ground, has to give ground. But it's slightly worse than that, because this is the easy stuff. As you go through the Brexit process, the Article 50 stuff is the easiest. Transition will be very, very hard. The lawyers don't know how to do it, and it's going to be a nightmare to negotiate. And then when it comes to negotiating a trade deal, that I wonder whether we will manage to do that at all, given the politics around free trade in continental Europe.
OK, and Heather, from a political point of view, watching it, some new characters have started to emerge and new groupings, people who are suddenly important, you know, Anna Soubry, Jacob Rees-Mogg. Was that aimed at Jacob or Anna? What's it like covering it and watching it?
Well, it's kind of fascinating because there's a sort of... Part of the impact of a hung parliament is that it only takes quite a small group of MPs to be quite influential. And so you constantly see this sort of shifting kaleidoscope of different groups of MPs. And, you know, there are cabinet members who are divided on this, and they have sort of groups of almost camp followers who see a particular person in cabinet as representing their view and, you know, speaking for them. And it's kind of fascinating. And you see these characters emerge. And of course, everybody also half has in the back of their minds, nobody thinks that the Conservatives will let Theresa May fight another general election. And so everybody's constantly thinking, could this person who's taking a stand on this, that or the other issue, the ECJ or whatever else it is, could this person be potential leadership material? And it makes for a very kind of febrile and, I mean, for us, for political journalists, rather fascinating atmosphere, but it's kind of unstable. There's an instability about it, I think.
Yeah, not quite strong and stable. I haven't asked you who came up with that, Chris.
Not me.
So what did you do when you were there?
I did the stuff. No.
One thing that you did was you wrote the Lancaster House speech along with many others. Do you feel like maybe there were almost too many red lines that you're now coming to regret?
I think at the time, the important thing about that speech was that it provided clarity to all concerned, and I think it absolutely did that job. The Europeans responded to it very well because they felt that for the first time we'd been really clear about kind of what our objectives were. I think both the sort of Remain and Leave sides of the Conservative Party responded well to it also, and there was a bit slightly something for everyone in it, which was good. And I was particularly pleased that the speech itself was put within a narrative about sort of a strong vision for the future of the country and the global Britain narrative, and the whole idea of doing it at Lancaster House and things like that were that all worked, I think, very well. And it was an attempt to be a unifying text, which I suspect people in this room will not sort of appreciate, but yeah, that was certainly the intention behind it.
And was there always the intention that you could slip back from that position?
I think they were described as negotiation objectives. You set out negotiation objectives, it doesn't necessarily mean that you achieve every single one of them. That's same in any negotiation. The thing I would like to pick up, though, because I think Anand is absolutely right on this, is that actually I think we almost have the framing of this all wrong. Everybody talks about this as a negotiation, but actually it isn't really a negotiation. You're absolutely right. When we wrote that speech, we were of the view that actually it would be possible to sort of appeal to governments in Europe and things like this, and to sort of get beyond the 27 view. Actually, the Europeans have been incredibly disciplined in holding that EU 27 view, and as Anand says, what they've effectively said is, well, here are your options, you pick the one you want. And they've been very effective in that, and so it's not a negotiation in that sense. Yeah.
They've held the line because they know if they don't, they'll start squabbling because they disagree fundamentally on issues to do with trade.
But they've managed to hide that, and they are united, whereas the Cabinet, you have three different positions in one Cabinet meeting. I think what Chris has said sums it up, really. Lancaster House speech was to get some unity in the Conservative Party. The whole process of Brexit from day one, including the referendum, has been about internal Conservative Party management. And that's why we had the referendum in the first place in that way, and the Conservative Party sort of worried about UKIP. And nobody seemed to think through the consequences. What about Gibraltar? What about Northern Ireland? What about trade deals? And where's the £350 million a week for the NHS?
But you've got a party in which there are clearly divides as well. Jeremy Corbyn has argued very publicly that we shouldn't be trying to remain in the single market. There are backbench Labour MPs who would do anything they can to remain in the single market.
It's not what he said, actually. If you look at what's been said, the Labour Party position is really clear on this now, and I'm very comfortable with it, is don't take anything off the table. We should stay in the customs union and the single market during transition, take nothing off the table and negotiate. I think our problem at the moment is that we don't know what's happening day by day. You know, we could take over in government and there's a complete chaotic mess to try and inherit, to have some negotiations. But the key thing on this is they've got to try and negotiate our way through this. At the moment, we could be in danger of the worst possible consequence, a catastrophic consequence of no deal. And that really is catastrophic. There is no good outcome on no deal at all, despite what some cabinet members say.
And I just want to push on that point. OK, Jeremy Corbyn wants to keep things on the table, but has made the argument that there are policies, for example, around state aid, that would be difficult if we remained in the single market. Is that true?
No, that's not true. And I think the Labour Party, the Labour position has moved. What my problem
is... But it is what Jeremy's argued.
It has been argued in the
past. Yeah, but he's not saying that now.
But I think, don't take anything off the table. For me, is we're not telling you.
You know, no, what is not. No, no.
Because
we're not in charge.
You must have a preference out of the things on the table, surely.
Yeah, well, we're not in charge of negotiations. At the moment, we want to keep everything in play, because what the Conservative Party did, and I think the Lancaster House speech was actually a disaster. We're ruling out this, we're ruling out that. Where do you negotiate if you rule everything out in the first place?
OK, and John, before we go to the most sketchable man on earth, let me just ask you about some of the other characters who are involved in these Brexit negotiations. Michel Barnier, Jean-Claude Juncker, Donald Tusk. What are they like to watch and observe?
Well, I only get to watch them off the telly, which is...
Can't the Guardian afford to send you to Brussels?
Apparently not, Anushka. So I only kind of see them on sort of the sort of Sky sort of bits and pieces that you, the clips that you see. But I have come to really enjoy the monthly press conferences between David Davis and Michel Barnier. In the very first press conference, I mean, Barnier said, we're not going to talk about trade or anything until we've talked about final settlement, EU citizen rights and Northern Ireland. And David Davis just said, yeah, that's fine.
But Anand, absolutely true, isn't it? Just before, you know, that they are making an argument which isn't going to be in our interest. And actually, some of these issues, we do need to move on to the next stage to fix.
I mean, it's political. There's nothing legal about this. And actually, to correct John, David Davis didn't say yes. David Davis first said, this will be the fight of the summer. And then he said yes.
It was a very short summer.
But we were never going to win that. The EU has simply just said, this is how it will be. And we've said, absolutely not, yes, repeatedly. I have to say, in David Davis' defence, some of the coverage, and I don't mean you, I mean, I just remember it from that first set of talks, he appeared at the table and he didn't have any papers in front of him. And we had this 2 days of headlines about the British government doesn't know what it's doing because he had no papers in front of him. I mean, it's ridiculous. Our civil service has done an awful lot of work on Brexit. There's an awful lot of information being amassed. Whether you want to call them impact assessments or not is totally up to you. But, you know, a lot of the background work has been done. And I just thought at that time, at the start of the negotiations, where we were subjected to these headlines about David Davis is unprepared, it was all getting a bit silly.
OK. Well, I'm just going to throw it over to Heather now, and a question that I suspect you'll come to in this section from Hamza Syed. Should Trump be allowed to visit?
Yeah, I think we should come to that. So no review of the year would be quite complete without a quick look across the Atlantic. And who could forget Theresa May dashing over to Washington in January to be the first leader to visit the new president and to hold his hand? I was there, not for the hand-holding, but for the press conference, and it was a kind of extraordinary moment of political theatre to see these two figures. You know, Donald Trump, this almost cartoonish figure, you know, all I'm able to confirm really is that, you know, he's even bigger and even oranger in real life than, you know, than you would see on the television. But Chris, for all the criticism, she did manage to get Trump to publicly commit to backing and funding NATO, didn't she? Was that planned? Was that part of the idea for the visit?
Yes, it was, absolutely. So just to take a step back and think about what the strategy behind the visit was, because it didn't exactly go according to plan. We had the invitation to go to the States as the first people to go and see the new president as he got through the door of the White House. What we actually did, if you forget this, was that we went to Philadelphia the day before to a Republican convention where the Prime Minister gave a speech which actually repudiated a lot of the Trump agenda. And the thinking had always been to actually go and actually align yourself with the mainstream of Republican thinking, who are going to be very important to us as the party effectively in government over there. Then go to the White House the following day and, this will sound funny, but keep a sort of discreet distance. Get him in front of the cameras and get him to commit to NATO. That all went very well. Then we got back to the British Embassy afterwards, and we sort of reflected and we thought, well, that sort of seemed to go okay, and that was all right. And then the Prime Minister said, yes, he did hold my hand at one stage. And we said, pardon? She said, yes, he held my hand. She said, did anyone get that on camera? Oh, yes, she said. And at that point, the strategy slightly fell apart, I'm afraid. But I mean, the serious point is, absolutely, it was about getting him to, actually showing our influence on the US by getting him to go in front of the camera and commit to NATO, which at the point was, at the time, was something he hadn't done, and he'd been making noises about doing quite the opposite. So from that point of view, actually, that was quite successful.
And I think you were at the lunch with him, were you?
I was at the lunch,
How was
yes.
that?
It was very nice. It was braised ribs. It was lovely.
Excellent.
It was an hour of the president telling us his views on lots of things.
Feel free to expound further.
I don't think I'll go into all the topics that were covered, but golf came up.
Yeah.
Golf courses came up.
Did he mention the immigration rules he was going to change the following
no,
day?
No, that might have been helpful.
A wall?
It really was quite wide-ranging. I think when you kick off a lunch and the sort of icebreaker over the appetizers is where you stand on the abortion limit, you realise it's not going to be your sort of standard kind of lunch, really.
No, and you quietly tuck into the ribs, I should imagine, at that point. And Angela, earlier in the year, the Speaker of the House of Commons said he would block Trump from addressing Houses of Parliament if this state visit goes ahead. Do you think now, with the sort of latest furore over him retweeting far-right British groups, should that visit just be off? Should it be formally cancelled, do you think?
It should never have been extended an invitation in the first place. It was over hasty. And I think, you know, Theresa May wasn't the first British politician to talk to Donald Trump. Actually, it was Nigel Farage was in there, so Theresa May couldn't be too far behind.
And Michael Gove interviewed him as well, didn't he?
Yes.
To remember.
Yeah. So and I think it was much more to do with, you know, hang on, we've got problems here in the EU. We're losing partners. We don't know what's going to happen, how this is going to work out. Let's make some friends across the water. Let's talk to Donald Trump so we can get chlorinated chicken into the UK. And I just thought it was all completely undignified. We didn't, you know, extend even President Kennedy, President Obama. It was some time before similar visits, invitations were extended to them. So I thought it was over hasty. I thought it was reckless. I certainly wouldn't want to be part of any state visit that Donald Trump made to this country. And I also think it was discourteous to the Queen, if I'm honest, because you're putting the Queen into a very political position that you wouldn't want to do. So I think the invitation shouldn't have been extended in the first place.
And there is a sort of realpolitik argument, isn't there, though, that we're leaving the EU, we need other global partners, that, you know, it's quite important to be close to the US.
Yeah, and, you know, Britain's got a long and proud tradition of running over the Atlantic whenever we've fallen out with Europe. I mean, prime ministers do that, you know. If things look a bit ropey with the continent, we go to the United States and we cuddle up to them. The problem now is it's a bit of a rock and a hard place situation, isn't it? Is that neither alternative looks particularly welcoming. And I think the really damaging thing for us about... Well, actually, no, let me not say that. One of the really damaging things for us about President Trump is his trade agenda. If central to our ambitions in terms of our relationship with the US is to get a trade deal because the US is a massive economy, we're dealing with a president who doesn't like trade, has said so publicly, is actually in the process of deciding whether to renege on existing agreements, and has made it perfectly clear when he negotiates, he will do so for American jobs. I mean, there could not be a worse partner for us when it comes to trade.
But it's also, you know, many of us here will know, have friends in America and friends on the liberal side of politics. And so many Americans are embarrassed. They're not supporting Trump. We shouldn't actually confuse that Trump's going to be there for a long time here. His popularity is falling. In some areas, it's sort of hardening, but generally, his poll figures aren't terribly good. So I just think, you know, if Donald Trump wants to come here, he's got a golf course he can visit. You know, he can get his passport stamped like lots of other people, but a state visit, a very quick, hasty invitation for a state visit was inappropriate.
But it'd be a hell of a sketch, wouldn't it?
Oh, you'd have a whale of a time.
You're in favour of it going ahead, John. I think we can expect.
And so before we throw it open to the floor, let's just do a quick round of sort of quick-fire predictions for the year ahead. Angela, another general election next year, do you think?
6 months ago, even 6 weeks ago, I'd have said no. But I just don't know. I think we're into the realms of politics. As Anne was saying, everything's been turned on its head. I think anything can happen. So there could well be an election. If there is, We're ready. They thought they weren't last time. We were, and we're ready this time. There could well be another election, but I just think I have this kaleidoscope theory of politics sometimes. Remember when you were a kid and you had a kaleidoscope? You turned it one little notch and everything changed. That's where we are politically now.
I don't think we could stand another election, Anoushka. What do you think? oh, you'll be on maternity leave. You'll be all right.
Oh, I'll be okay. Yeah. I'm just popping off for that election.
Oh, dear, don't, please, please don't do it to me. Chris, do you think Theresa May will still be leader of the Tory party and Prime Minister this time next year?
I do, but equally I agree with Angela that you can't sort of predict anything in politics these days. I mean, who knows? But yes, I do. I think she has basically the parliamentary party largely on side. I think people underestimate the extent to which the parliamentary party are backing her.
Only because they don't know anybody else.
And it may be that they don't have other candidates, but equally, I think she is secure there. She's got a reasonable enough, not majority in the House of Commons, but enough MPs behind her to keep her there. So yes, absolutely. But as I say, I'm slightly past predicting anything in politics these days.
We're all a bit wary of predicting something, aren't we, these days, I think. And John, of those sort of potential leadership candidates that we sort of hinted at and talked about a bit earlier, who's your favourite to sketch? You know, if it had to be Rees Mogg, or it had to be, I don't know, Nicky Morgan or Ruth Davidson, or, you know, who's...
It's sort of hard to put a kind of... the point about it is that the sort of characters emerge. I had no idea that Theresa May was going... I mean, as Home Secretary, she was sort of quite hard work to sketch quite often. You know, I was sort of limited to her exchanges with Keith Vaz. Remember him? He was head of the Home Affairs Select Committee, and they kind of... were quite combative with each other, and that was always good. That was always good entertainment. But I had no idea that she was going to be sketch gold. and I mean, for that reason, I sort of hope that she does stay in power, really.
And will Britain and the EU be any closer to a deal, or should we all just tune out for a few months?
This is going to last a decade or more, so buckle in.
But I think. <you know.
Yeah. laughs> Yeah, that's not sketch gold, is it?
No, I think what was going to happen probably by this time next year, we'll have a transitional arrangement and we'll be figuring out whether we can get it through Parliament. But the trade deal will still be 5-6 years away.
Should we throw it open? Should we throw it open to the floor, Anoushka?
Yeah. Let's take questions from the floor. We'll take them in threes, if that's OK. And then we'll come back to the panel. So who has a question?
I don't know if it's just me, but I haven't heard too much from Mrs. Gove and Johnson in the last few weeks. I just wondered what the panel's thoughts were about what they're up to at the moment. Are they too busy plotting to put their oar in, or what's the score with them?
Okay, thank you.
Can you explain why Boris Johnson, Michael Gove and so on have been brought into the cabinet, and particularly Boris Johnson into the Foreign Office?
I love the sketch gold thing, and all of your sketches are gold, John.
Has he mentioned he's written a book about?
I'm saying nothing.
As was the conversation this evening, a lot to laugh about. But how much has the last year brought us closer to World War III?
Okay, so we've got Michael Gove, Boris Johnson and World War III. Okay, serious question. Boris Johnson as Foreign Secretary.
I can tell you my view on why it was. I wasn't around when that decision was made. So I will give you my view. I'm just saying that I'm not offering a particular insight and not speaking for anyone else. But I think Boris is undoubtedly a big figure in the party and had done actually a really good job as London Mayor and was thought to have done a good job there. He needs to be found a place somewhere. The view was actually what you need in that role is somebody who's, how to put this nicely, but who can, effectively a good salesman for the country. I can't speak for others. I'm giving you my interpretation of what I think the thinking was, and that's what I believe happened.
And Heather, what do you think Gove and Johnson are up to at the moment?
Well, they're definitely making their voices heard in the conversations in Cabinet about what kind of trade deal we end up with and what kind of future relationship with the EU we end up with. And in fact, Philip Hammond confirmed today there hasn't yet been a formal discussion in Cabinet about what kind of deal we end up with. And there's a reason for that. That's because Theresa May knows it's going to be very, very difficult to take all of those people, and in particular to take Boris Johnson and Michael Gove with her, once we start to talk about what kind of relationship we have and whether, for example, we'll be able to slash red tape and to change our rules and to have a very different kind of trade regime to the rest of the EU. So I think they're sitting back slightly, but they're making their voices heard, and she knows she's got a struggle ahead in keeping those sort of key pro-Brexit figures and the kind of wider supporters of them out there on the back benches on side. So they are constraining what the Prime Minister is doing and her room for manoeuvre, even though, you know, perhaps we're not hearing so much from them publicly. Michael Gove actually is reinventing himself as a kind of crusading green, isn't he, in Defries?
He loves animals.
He loves animals a lot.
And he also loves experts now.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
And on that point, it's quite technical, but there's a big debate about regulatory alignment this week. How much could Boris Johnson or Michael Gove cause a problem on those issues?
I've got a slightly different take to Heather, in the sense that what I've detected over the last couple of weeks is a certain sense of concern amongst the Brexiters that things are so wobbly that Brexit might be in doubt. And what I took from the whole story over the Brexit bill and the fact that the Daily Mail said, yeah, bargain at half the price in its headline after they'd announced it, was that the Brexiters have decided that actually priority number one is to make sure we get out. March the 29th, we leave. That's our primary objective. If Theresa May needs us to get on side for things we don't particularly like at the moment, that's a price worth paying to get us out. So I think they've rowed back in their criticism because she was looking so unstable, the danger was that she would fall and the whole thing would be broken open again. And so on that side, at least, from the whole Europe Research Group and Boris and Gove, I think she's facing slightly less pressure than she did before. That can all change.
Gentleman over there, lady behind him, and then lady here, and then the next round we'll do on this side.
Hi, I'd like to get the panel's view on the decision to go enter a deal with the DUP and how that will now impact the Brexit negotiations.
Hello, my name's Carol Riley. I'd like to know what the panel think, or why the panel think, Jeremy Corbyn hasn't been an effective opposition.
Okay. Do they think that? Well, we'll find out. Who's the last person here?
Hi. As a mother of a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old, you know, I absolutely hear the, you know, general depression about the state of Brexit and world politics and World War III, etc. What's the panel's view on how the young can make this better?
Okay.
Because it can't be worse.
Angela, I think you need to take all three of those. So, DUP, Corbyn, is he being effective? And the young?
On the DUP, you know, I spent 3.5 years as a Northern Ireland minister, so I've dealt with all the political parties in Northern Ireland. And I just think it was, a rash short-term decision of Theresa May to jump into bed with the DUP. And I think a lot of her own party questioned why she did this. And if we saw anything in the last week, it's why she shouldn't have done that at all. She could have got that through Parliament without the DUP, but she's so hidebound to the DUP. Anyway, what you do for, was it £1 billion they got for Northern Ireland? Million?
It was £1.5 billion.
Right, it probably goes up maybe a bit more. And this myth that somehow the DUP represent Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland voted Remain. The DUP is the only political party in Northern Ireland to support Leave. So the implications, I think, for the government are poor, and the implications for the negotiations. You've got this very small group that are holding the whole government and negotiations to ransom in many ways. I dispute the not effective opposition, though I'm disappointed we're not further ahead in the polls, though a new poll said we were this week. But having been through an election where the polls got it wrong, I'm not sure I necessarily believe the polls. So time will tell, but I think, you know, our front bench team as a whole, and Jeremy, have really got motoring more recently on that. To be fair to Jeremy, that was a very new role to him. And, you know, being at that dispatch box the first time, do not underestimate what that is like. On TV, you can't quite hear. You're standing there speaking and they are baying and jeering at you. And, you know, it's not a comfortable place to be when that goes on. We're much more sedate in the House of Lords. Just have the Prime Minister staring at you. So I think, you know, I think we've done very well as a party. I'm proud to know the fellow cabinet where I sit with my colleagues. They are a very effective team, and I'd feel a lot more comfortable with that lot in power than I do with the current shambles. What's the third one, remind me?
Oh, young people.
When Joe Cox was murdered, it was a very difficult time, I think, for everybody involved in politics and watching that. And I made a speech in the House of Lords. One of the things I said that I want, when young people say to their families, I want to get involved in politics, they want to be proud of them, not fear for them. And I think there's an obligation on everybody here to actually encourage young people. How many people now, and I'm not asking for a show of hands, but how many people, if your son, your daughter, your niece or your nephew said, I want to go into politics, you say, oh, be careful, social media, do you really want to do this? And they're exactly the people we need. So I think we've got to identify role models. People like Angie Rayner, you know, great woman, out there, says what she thinks, tells it like she is from an ordinary background, a very difficult background, but she's out there making a case. So I think we need to, you know, say the next generation, this is your future, and really encourage and support young people coming forward. But that's, I think, for society as a whole. And we have to call out those people who abuse, whether it's social media or publicly. It's got so much worse since I was an MP. You can't post anything now without getting abuse. I don't know of a single female MP, and probably a few as men as well, who hasn't had a death threat. You know, it's outrageous in this day and age. And you don't know if they're serious or not. If you get something through social media, is that somebody who knows you? Does somebody know your movements? And that, I think, is where we have to say we want to be proud of young people who want to go forward, encourage them to speak out, not necessarily through the youth parliament or formal organisations, but to be themselves and be confident to speak out. And I think getting those younger people involved, just praise them, congratulate them, and just keep pushing them, because we need them. The age of politicians, particularly, actually, interesting, this is for your column, John. The three party leaders in the House of Lords are younger than three party leaders in the House of Commons. Times are changing. So I'm not saying young people should go to the House of Lords, but certainly we need young people getting engaged in their communities, whether it's on local councils, which I think the role of a councillor is greatly underrated and undersold in this country. We need good local councillors, good MPs, good people in businesses, in think tanks, in pressure groups, all that's been involved. But just all of us have got to do something to make sure that if a young person says to us, I want to do this, don't fear for them, but support them.
OK, just I'm going to ask you three for quick answers on these so I can take in some more questions. DUP, was that a mistake?
I think that it possibly was rash what happened. You have to remember, I mean, the context of the time, it was incredibly febrile, uncertain. It was not the result any of us anticipated. And I remember actually being around then, and there was pressure from all quarters, and actually also from you know, officials and civil service, things like that, to have some stability, you know, because we're
civil
in the Brexit negotiations. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there was pressure from all quarters to have an answer to the question about kind of like, what is, you know, how do we show the Europeans actually that there is stability here. And so I can understand why the decision was made
on reflection.
On reflection, I think maybe trying for a minority government might be better.
OK. John, I mean, the DUP are much more influential than they ever have been before. And also, is Jeremy Corbyn an effective opposition at the moment?
Two things. DUP, I kind of felt at the time that it was a sort of done deal, that she was going to go for it. It was, she needed a confidence and supply to get her administration through. And I think there was a real concern amongst the Conservatives that the government could just fall and there would be another general election within months, really. I mean, obviously it's a disaster, but that sort of goes without saying, really. But I can sort of see why she did it. Jeremy Corbyn, is he? I think he's getting better. I mean, I'm not so convinced as you, Angela, that the Labour Party has a sort of strong position on Brexit. And it feels like the sort of the leadership of sort of John McDonald and Jeremy Corbyn is still kind of old school distrusting of Brexit. And there's a lot of members of the cabinet and virtually everyone on the backbench other than Kate Hoey sort of trying to ease him into saying, look, single market and customs union is the way forward. And I think when they can actually speak as one voice and be coherent and be believed, then he will become more effective.
On the same point, Anand, just very quickly, so I can take in this side.
Can I say something very quickly about youth afterwards? I mean, I think Jeremy Corbyn has got a lot better. I think, you know, the one striking thing about the last election was the degree to which it was clear they want power. And they're learning to triangulate, as we saw in the manifesto. They're learning to be professional politicians. I mean, one big constraint on Jeremy Corbyn, of course, is some of his most talented colleagues have condemned themselves or been condemned to the backbenchers. So some of the best performers in the Labour Party are not in the shadow cabinet, which obviously weakens them as a force. Just on young people, I just want to say something very quickly. I think it's fantastic more of them voted, and I think they'll get an enormous payoff for that, because next election all parties will have a manifesto section on young people, because they've noticed that. But there are two structural constraints when it comes to young people, one of which we can do something about, one of which we can't. The one we can't do anything about is that young people, there aren't enough of them. We're an old society. They're always going to lose the electoral game, even if all of them voted. Us oldies would outnumber them. So that's just a fact of life. The second thing is we need to reform our education system, and we need to do something about the hideous inequality that plagues part of these countries that means that kids grow up without prospects just because of where they were born. That's how we help young people. We deal with that.
Okay. I'm going to take... You've got to be so quick. Do it for me. 20 seconds or 30 seconds. The arm up there at the back. The lady here with the striped top and the lady here at the front. I'm sorry to the others.
OK, thank you, John Galloway. The mess we're in has come about largely to do with managing internal Tory party politics around Europe. Do you think we'll actually leave Europe eventually? Do you think that will come about? And secondly, who do you think is the worst Prime Minister since the Second World War? Is it David Cameron or is it Theresa May?
Catherine Skingsley, I was hoping you could expand on the kind of pithy comment earlier that the rich voted Labour in the last election and the poor voted Tory. Do you view this as being a more permanent shift in the way that the electorate votes? Or is this more of a shorter term thing as a hangover from Brexit and the way that the last campaigns were run?
I was just wondering, in this day and age with the events of the past year, how important do you think that being nice and being a good person is in politics?
Okay. Okay, so when you answer these questions, it's also probably going to be your final intervention of the night, just so you know, because we've only got 5 minutes left. John, why don't you start?
Will we leave the EU? I believe we will, but I kind of hope that it will be a fudge of some kind, and so that we end up sort of still in the single market and customs union somehow. I hope that it will just become apparent that it's so complicated and so difficult to do it any other way, that, you know, it just happens by osmosis, if not anything else. And David Cameron or Theresa May, Theresa May more sketchable, David Cameron worse.
Okay. And Andy, your comment was a bit flippant. I mean, actually, if you look at the working class vote, it's fairly divided, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the Tories increased their share of the working class. And it was a very, very quick generalisation. But it speaks to something that's really important in our country now, which is the massive and profound economic and political divide between towns and cities. Okay, Labour is the party of cities, the Tories are the party of towns. Towns voted overwhelmingly to leave, most cities voted to remain. Towns are in decline economically, cities are doing better than towns economically. And that is something we need to start thinking about. And we need to start coming up with policy solutions that are sensitive to these kind of regional and geographic decisions. So obviously it's not the case that all poor people voted Tory, all people voted Labour. All I'm saying is those trends are changing. Is it permanent? God, who knows? I mean, it could change. The one undeniable fact about the British electorate at the moment is it's as volatile as it's ever been, which means that party loyalties are weak, people switch. I have no idea what will happen next time. Do I have to say something about Prime Ministers or not?
Oh, you can't go on then. Choose.
I think we will leave the European Union, and I think Cameron and Osborne have so much to answer for in terms of both the state of the country and what has happened via the referendum.
Quick fire on those two questions, Heather. Leaving Europe and...
I think we will leave, but I don't feel as certain about that as I would have done perhaps a year ago, because, you know, the difficulties of it are coming ever more clear. Although I think if we didn't leave, then you've got a huge democratic problem with those people who came out and voted in great numbers. I totally agree with Anand on Prime Ministers.
Yet, by the way.
I haven't mentioned your book. That was your last intervention. You've missed it, mate. Sorry. The moment's passed. I absolutely agree. David Cameron and George Osborne. Theresa May, to a large extent, has played the hand she's been dealt. She was always going to be the Brexit Prime Minister.
Are we going to leave the EU?
Yes, we will leave the EU, absolutely.
Are you sad about it?
I would rather we had never had the referendum.
And who was worse, May or Cameron?
surprisingly, I'm not going to answer that. Aren't we out of time, I think, though?
You can say Tony Blair.
You can go, yeah, it's post-World War II. Final question on, I mean, you can also answer the others as well, but also just taking that question about things like Grenfell, etc. I mean, and being a nice person in politics.
Right. Cameron, undoubtedly, he based on the short term, everything was done on a short term decision making process. And when things got tough, he cleared off, having said he'd stay. So undoubtedly, Cameron. Are we going to leave the EU? We probably will, but the terms on which we leave the EU and how much we can salvage from the wreckage that the government have tried to bring upon us will be absolutely key. And actually, I think it is very important to try and be a nice person in politics. If you can't bring the values with you to politics, if you can't actually be decent to the people you work with, how can you be decent to the country or be decent in policy making? So actually, I still think somebody being decent is really important in politics.
Well, that's a nice thing to think about for 2018 as we end. And I would like to give my thanks to all of you for coming, and to our brilliant panel, Angela Smith, Chris Wilkins, John Crace, Anand Menon. For our weekly dose of this sort of thing, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
But for now, that's all from us. We've been Heather Stewart and Anushka Astana. Thanks for being here and for listening.